Good morning, all.
Good morning.
The first case for argument this morning is the United States versus Jackson. Mr. Abrams?
Yes. If it may please the court, in this particular case, in regards to S.C. Jackson, who is my client, it appears that justice seems to have failed S.C. Jackson in this case. And we've raised three issues in regards to how that has occurred. In this particular case, S.E. Jackson purchased a 1999 Ford Exhibition through the help of her son, Joe Jackson. That vehicle had previously been in an accident, and it was sold for salvage, in which they paid $6,800 for that car. These facts are significant in regards to what occurred during the jury trial in this case, Your Honors. The vehicle was repaired, and there was testimony in this case that the car in a good state could be worth as much as $35,000. That fact is important in regards to one of the co-defendants, Angela Jackson, who at the time when she purchased this car from Essie Jackson, because Essie could no longer drive it because it was too large for her. What happened was is they had an agreement to sell the car. Angela agreed to purchase it for $30,000 from her. When that car, after it had been repaired and sold to Angela, it subsequently was stolen. And Angela Jackson put in a claim to the insurance company in the amount of $32,000.
Mr. Abrams,
yes.
May forgive me for interrupting you, but I think what we need to do here is deal with the basic issue at hand, which is Essie Jackson's conviction for conspiracy to commit and to look at, you know, the evidence. The three purchases, the three inflated values, thefts, the damages to the vehicle, the insurance claims on all three vehicles, because there's a pattern that seems to emerge. Got a client who was the nominal purchaser of the vehicles, signed key documents, such as the sales agreements, the title, so forth.
Yes, ma'am. Okay.
As we've read the briefs, of course.
Yes, and I understand that. What occurred in this case in regards to Essie, Your Honor, is that when the government comes forward and says she couldn't have had the money to purchase this car, that evidence was without question misleading to the jury. The government had the bank records of Essie Jackson. They introduced only the May record and says to the jury and argues to the jury and presents witnesses that she did not have those funds in the bank. When, in fact, if we would have looked 3 days earlier into the April statement, those funds were in the bank, and they were withdrawn, and were sufficient funds to purchase the first vehicle.
That brings up the newly discovered evidence problem, because I am very curious as to why you view the April 2000 bank statement as newly discovered evidence that would warrant a new trial, because she was the account holder. So the evidence, it would seem, was always available to her. And couldn't she have presented it at trial if she thought the government wasn't presenting a picture of her bank transaction?
The answer to your question is yes. However, that's where justice failed, Essie. On both sides of the aisle, the government presenting false evidence, and on the other side of the aisle, her attorney's incompetence for not getting those records or introducing those records or cross-examining the witnesses, which became absolutely no cross-examination to a crucial part of this case.
And forgive me once again, because you need to make a decision here on whether or not Ms. Jackson truly wants to pursue the ineffectiveness claim at this, you know, on direct appeal. Because she'll, you know, she only gets one shot at that claim, and if she pursues it now, she cannot come back on a 2255 and try to make the same claim based on the expanded record. So you know, before you sit down, you need to make a decision whether you want to.
That decision has been made, and one of the reasons is a practical effect of my client is due to be out in March. So the 2255 will really only deal with the restitution claim that is made here. We believe it was ineffective assistance of counsel for, number one, not presenting the records, number two, not cross-examining the witnesses, if, in fact, those records were turned over by the government. We do know the government had them. They've never denied having the April records. And the 3 days difference in regards to the government standing before a jury and saying to that jury, look, we have no idea where this $4,000 came from except by Joe's testimony. Well, in fact, the bank records in this case were clear that she could purchase that vehicle with it. The second part of this issue, Your Honor, in regards to the incompetent counsel, if you take a look at the record, the cross-examination by him of the bank officer had nothing to do with the regards to the withdrawals that were in there. I don't think she was represented properly, Judge. What occurred, again, in regards to all of this, in regards to the conspiracy, we're talking about the other vehicles that you have raised. The other vehicles, what had occurred was that after the first vehicle insurance payoff, and where there was a defraud by the insurance company in that case, I don't know, because the insurance company knew the vehicle had previously been damaged. It knew what the value of that car was. The claim was for $32,000. The insurance company turns around and settles for $21,000, knowing it had been previously damaged, but yet repaired. Nobody denies the vehicle was purchased. Nobody denies that the vehicle was repaired. So the insurance company paid $21,000. How were they defrauded in this case in regards to that vehicle? That vehicle gets paid off. The second vehicle comes. And when the second vehicle comes, Essie signs off on the lien so that now her daughter-in-law can get another vehicle. They have the same arrangement for the payment of the $30,000, which has been now, at this time point in time, then reduced to $28,000 to continue to pay the $500 a month. She goes out and buys the second vehicle. Where is the conspiracy where that vehicle is damaged by a snowplow from the city? Did they plan the snowplow to hit the car? They then make the subsequent, of course not, they then make the subsequent claim on the insurance. Essie basically has nothing to do with the claim other than she has a lien, again, on the title for the money that Angela owes her. And she wants to make sure that Angela has the car insured so just in case she could get paid. So the second car now is damaged. They put in a claim. The aftermarket auto parts that are put in the car, Essie has nothing to do with. She never has anything to do with the insurance claim on that. She never has anything to do with the purchase of it. What we do know subsequently that there was some other motions for newly discovered evidence in regards to Joe Jackson, which showed that those auto parts were actually paid for by the automobile dealership that put the parts on the car rather than Joe having paid. Now, I don't know if anybody had gotten that evidence at the time of trial, and it didn't appear that they did. But in the motions for newly discovered evidence that were placed on behalf of Joe, we do know that those car parts were paid for by the auto dealership, and Joe then paid the auto dealership rather than the parts store.
You're into your rebuttal, Mr. Abrams.
Yes,
it's your time, but I just want to remind you.
If I can just finish my thought in regards to the third car. The third car that was purchased, again, was done in the same manner. The government says these are sham agreements. That's why this is a conspiracy. Where's the evidence that there's any sham agreements, that they had not agreed that the cost of the car would be $30,000, and that debt continued to go down the line in regards to three cars? Nobody denies that the cars were stolen. Nobody denies that the car was damaged. Where's the conspiracy? Conspiracy to do what? What insurance company was defrauded out of what money? There was $21,000 paid. They knew that car had previously been damaged. The second car, they saw the damage to the vehicle. The question came up about the after-purchase products that were put onto the car. The third vehicle, they denied the claim. I don't believe there was any conspiracy here, and I think the government's misrepresentation is part of the problem.
Thank you. All right. Thank you, Mr. Abrams. Mr. Barber?
Honors. May it please the Court, for Joe Jackson. Joe Jackson's appeal is about a failure of proof by the government. They had the burden, and with the limited amount of time, with the Court's indulgence, I'd like to focus in on count five, which goes specifically to conduct by Joe Jackson.
Well, then let me ask you a question about count five, because you argued with respect to that count that any misrepresentation as to the performance plus receipt wasn't material in the sense that the insurance company didn't base what it paid on what Mr. Jackson paid for the wheels, but rather what they were worth. But doesn't an insurance company typically insist on receipts for stolen or damaged equipment, and isn't such proof material, even if it doesn't determine the amount the insurance company ultimately pays? In other words, doesn't an insurance company want receipts as the means of showing that the insured had legitimate possession of the equipment and hadn't stolen it, for example?
That's part of it, Your Honor, and we're not making the reliance argument. We're not saying that because they the insurance company may or may not have acted based on that. That's not the argument we're pressing. The point here with the receipts is that the part of the receipt on which the insurance company was primarily focused, and J.R. Prankert at Gates was primarily focused, was the amount, the cost. When he sat down with his insurance with the insurance contract for AAA, I mean, that's his universe. It's, you know, items that are in or on the vehicle, and then he drops down to the policy language and looks at, in this case, at the replacement cost. The material part of that receipt is how much those rims and tires cost.
No, the fact that the insurance company insists on proof of the cost of the wheels, and we have Mr. Jackson supplying a fraudulent receipt in response to that request, surely that's enough to show materiality.
It would be, Your Honor, if proof of that was in the record. You and I can speculate about whether or not the insurance company would view that as material. And certainly the government had an opportunity twice, three times actually, because J.R. Prankert testified for Gates, then William Locke testified, and then they recalled him. He's the AAA investigator. And in no instance did the government ask, and I think this question goes to the heart of it, if they had asked any one of those witnesses, if you had known that Joe Jackson had not gotten those rims from Performance Plus, would that have a tendency or the ability to influence, not whether it did, but would it have a tendency? And I think if you look at the Seventh Circuit case law on this, and it has a fairly well-developed materiality case law, particularly cases like Davis and Ghirdalucci on the other side, what you see, the dividing line, is somebody, a witness, testified and said the statements had a tendency to influence me. In Ghirdalucci at 547, they talk about the witnesses on the record saying, I know there was an anti-reliance clause in the contract, but the type of statements they were making had the ability to influence me. It's not a reliance argument. It's not a question of whether they did or did not. But somebody said that there was an ability to influence.
And look, even if insurance company doesn't actually rely on the receipt, but let's say instead bases its payment on the value of the wheels rather than what Jackson paid for them. A fraudulent receipt would still, it seems to me, be material in the sense that the insurance company wants it, and it has a tendency to affect whatever decision the insurance company would make. I mean, it just seems proof in the way of receipts. Is this something standard that insurance companies want? I mean, logically, I just have a hard time disregarding the relevance of a fraudulent receipt for something that someone is seeking compensation for. And boy, this receipt was fraudulent, wasn't it?
Well, the provenance of the receipt is fraudulent. The actual receipt itself accurately reflects the replacement cost of those rims. It's not the the government talks about it being a doctored receipt and an altered receipt. It's important.
Well, it isn't even his card. It's a stolen discovery card, isn't it?
Well, Your Honor, it's
from Florida or somewhere.
It's not. It's important to point out that any evidence of credit card fraud has never been linked, and at least last I had heard, nobody had ever been prosecuted for that, and certainly nobody related to this conspiracy, alleged conspiracy, has ever been charged with that. But going back to your point, Your Honor, I don't disagree that it might be relevant, and I don't disagree that there are instances where it might be material. But the problem here is this is an element of the crime that this court has said in Davis. It's the burden on the government to prove beyond a reasonable doubt, and they didn't do that. And whether you and I or a juror can suppose that logically this would influence an insurance company is not the burden on the government. And particularly when the government has insurance company representatives on the stand, it's a simple question to ask.
But it's not required as a dispositive matter. The cases that you referred to don't require that, even though that may have been part of the fact pattern in those cases. It's a logical inference, as Judge Rovner has been pointing out, that if an insurance claimant submits certain documentation as part of the proof of his claim, that material is material to that claim. And why isn't that enough?
Because in at least in the insurance fraud context, a lot of the behavior and the conduct of the parties is governed by the insurance contract. And that's the universe they operate in. And insurance contracts will vary depending on the subject matter. And it's important to get, I think, when you look at the language, the test is a tendency or capability of influencing the decision maker to which the representation was made. It seems to me, and this is where I think Davis gets it right, and you're right, Your Honor, it's not a requirement, but I do think there's a reason the cases break down on both sides, is that when you're putting the government to its burden on this, and you have the opportunity to establish beyond a reasonable doubt, they certainly can draw that evidence out. And to suppose that in a variety of cases that because you or I might view it as material, that the insurance company did, when the government had an opportunity to find that out for themselves, it seems to me to be letting the government off the hook a bit. It's not a difficult burden for them to satisfy in this case. As I pointed out, they could have asked a very simple question which would have resolved. Now, there may be a reason why they didn't ask the question.
Now, what would be the question you think should have been asked, Mr. Barber?
Had you known, either to the Gates representative or to the AAA investigator, had you known that Joe Jackson had not gotten those rims from Performance Plus? So you're not implicating credit card fraud. You're not implicating his story at trial. Would you have viewed that evidence as having a tendency or capability of influencing your decision-making? Not whether it did or did not, but I think that resolves it. If they may say no, or they may say yes. If they say yes, they've satisfied the element.
Didn't this receipt on its face show that it was purchased, that is, the wheels were purchased in April of 2002?
Yes, Your Honor.
And wasn't the actual car purchased in June of 2002?
Correct. And that it's not, I agree, there is a question of the timing there. It fits better with Joe Jackson's testimony at trial that if one believes that if these were purchased as a result of credit card fraud, that the woman he met on that came up to him and offered to sell them, one would suppose that she had gotten them in April and then several months later had given them to him. There's certainly a misrepresentation with respect to where Joe Jackson got the rims and tires. He tells J.R. Prankert one thing. He testifies at trial at another, and obviously the Discover card fraud raises a different cloud over this. But that's not – on this record, we just don't know whether or not that was material. As I've said, I don't disagree that normal people would view that as material, but I don't believe under this circuit's case law that that's the standard.
Are you saying we're not normal people?
I'm saying we're very normal. But.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Barber. Ms. Brooke.
Good morning, and I think you're very normal. And so did 12 people during this trial. I am Barbara Brooke, and I was the trial attorney on this case. And if you have any factual questions, I'll try and ask them. This is a very long road, as you can see, and very complicated. But really, when you boil it to its essence, the scheme was very sophisticated. It was very smooth, but they got all tripped up on the third vehicle. And just to give you a little history to it, it was the third vehicle that began to go backwards and unravel what this family was doing. I'll deal with S.E. Jackson first.
Could I just ask you something real quickly?
Sure.
With respect to the specialized equipment on the 99 Expedition and the 2001 Bourbon, was it the government's theory that some of this equipment was not actually in or on the vehicles, or simply that the value was inflated?
I believe it's the 99 GMC that had the electronic equipment with the Elmos, Exhibits 14A and 14B. Is that what you're referring to? The theme underneath this, yes, there was no evidence because obviously, I'll tell you, this electronic equipment with this family was the slipperiest equipment that one can imagine. It couldn't stay in a vehicle for any lifetime of the vehicle. The theory of the government's case is they produce a receipt that turns out to be just estimates. Joe Jackson goes into Elmo Stereo for the second vehicle, the 1999 GMC, and says, according to the owner of Elmo's, Mr. Bernasco, I just need for insurance purposes, this is what was in the vehicle and what would it cost. And that's what the owner testified to. The fact that you cannot recover, it's gone, so you really don't know. But he represents it to J.R. Prinkert, the direct repair service for AAA, that this is, in fact, what we purchased for this vehicle, and that's what was in it. The scheme to defraud is half-truth intended. I mean, Joe Jackson never came in and said, you know what, we can't find the receipts. This is the best we can do. These are estimates. No, he adopts them as fact and presents them as, in fact, that these were in the vehicle. And it's the same thing with the Performance Plus receipt. He goes in, and let me say this first. He tells J.R. Prinkert, these are the wheels that I purchased from this company on this vehicle. And in order to prove, as you all know, a scheme to defraud is you have to prove a negative. How do we prove it? Well, you prove that whatever the representation was isn't true or it was false. In this case, both. This was a twofer. I mean, the credit card fraud, and again, I understand the possibility of prejudice, but as Judge Miller found, the probative value far outweighed any prejudice to Joe Jackson about this receipt because this was material. And let me just comment on materiality and the Davis case. Joe Jackson makes much of the Davis case, but nothing could be farther from the facts of this case. First of all, the Davis case involved a check to the IRS. The bank was not at risk for that check. That's what Judge Posner said in Davis. The government insures financial institutions against fraud. But for that IRS check, I mean, that's IRS's problem, but it wasn't the bank's problem. The bank was not at risk. Juxtapose that to the insurance company. They paid out, and let me talk about that. There should have been evidence that someone from AAA should have come in and said, yes, we would have never paid out had we not. You can't, J.R. Prigid says, why did you want a receipt? Because AAA tells me I need a receipt. What do you do with the receipt? You look at the receipt, you see how much the tires were, and that's why we added Exhibit 17. Right in Exhibit 17 is the cost of one tire. What more do you want for capable of influencing the decision of the decision maker when it is right there in the documents that AAA is using to pay the claim?
Well, why would the receipt be material if there was no dispute that the wheels were on the damaged vehicle and the insurance company based the amount of its payment on the value rather than the price paid for the wheels? I mean, I understand, as I think I made abundantly clear, that the insurance company wants and asks for receipts. But would the record here tell us how such receipts actually matter to the insurance company decision-making process?
Because that's what they actually paid. The company, when you carry the specialized coverage, it's just like if you have jewelry and you schedule it.
Uh-huh.
You have receipts. You have had an appraisal.
Uh-huh.
You submit that appraisal to the insurance company. That's why you carry the extra coverage. So when Joe Jackson says, this is what I, $4,000 I paid for these rims and tires, it is telling, he is telling the insurance company that this is what is due us because we carry this specialized coverage. And when you see it in black and white, literally factored into the insurance payoff, both in the notations to the check that was issued, it said, and for customs wheels and tires. And I just want to clear up immediately. There is no dispute that the city of South Bend car hit that vehicle. What is interesting to the scheme is the vehicle is towed, what, four blocks down the street to Essie Jackson's house, and just miraculously all the stereo equipment disappears. But the point I want to make is Joe Jackson is arguing, no, I understand under criminal law, not common law, there doesn't need to be any reliance. But that is what he's arguing. And there need not be any reliance. And that's why the case law is clear in the Seventh Circuit that it is it capable of influencing. And half-truths work. And how do you, you know, the jury is sitting there, and what's not captured in black and white is the dynamics of the witnesses. And that's why you, in the light most favorable to the government, whether the court has abused its discretion in its evidentiary rulings, that is why the district court is in that position. But let me move back to SE. I need to clear something up, and I thought I had done it in the briefs. I do not believe, and we've checked our records, that the government had the April 2000 bank record. I mean, we've checked the subpoenas, asked the postal inspector, and so, you know, I will concede it was not turned over from what I can tell. But what I'm saying is, where is that, one, exculpatory? It is not exculpatory. S.E. Jackson was on the stand and said that money never came from my bank accounts. Unless I've missed something, I'm not quite sure what S.E. Jackson is arguing now. Two, the key thing is, so was it suppressed? No, this is not like Dirty Shorts in the Miller versus Pay case. It was her bank records, and that's what Judge Miller ruled. It's her bank records.
Even if you had had it, could you have suppressed it? But could there be suppression here?
No. And would it have made a difference? Absolutely not. in light of her testimony, which then bootstraps the ineffective assistance of counsel. And I, you know, I've asked this court, let's just go ahead and deal with it if they're not going to withdraw it. Obviously, I don't know the conversations between her and her counsel. But she was on that stand. She was defiant. And again, that's not picked up in the, and she said that money didn't come from my bank accounts. She never once said I had plenty of money, I have other accounts, I have nothing. She just, you know, sat there and she said that was my money and I had it. And then obviously the cost of repairing grew exponentially every time the insurance agent talked to her. The inference is she had to call her son or daughter before she could answer the questions to Mark Eichenauer. And that's why it just seemed to grow depending upon which conversation. So this April 2000 showed nothing. It showed nothing. At the most, it certainly showed where the money came for the $2,000 cashier's check, which was not disputed, that was issued to her for the original down payment. But the rest of the money towards that Ford Expedition. And again, that was, as she said, the rolling over. I mean, these people put $7,000 or $7,900 into a vehicle and got a $21,000 return on their investment. And then were able to purchase over $10,000 worth of specialized equipment at the detriment of the insurance companies that paid those first couple claims. And what did they end up with? A $16,000 2001 Chevy Suburban with what, almost $11,000 of custom and stereo equipment that fortuitously disappeared at the taste of sugar. They held these cars a year. What an appreciation in value and a return on your investment with very little out of pocket. And that was the scheme to defraud. Is there any other?
Apparently not. Thank you, Ms. Brooks.
Okay, you're welcome.
Abrams, did you have you had 1 minute for rebuttal?
Your Honor, conceding to this court that these documents that we're talking about were material. Let's presume that they were. How is S.E. Jackson connected to that? What you have is this misrepresentation of the withdrawals from her bank account, and then the introduction of these documents that Joe Jackson created or got or whatever they were, and let's presume that they were material. What must be shown by the case law is that the defendant, S.E. Jackson, knew this conspiracy existed between, I guess, him and Angela, that she understood the essential nature of that conspiracy to somehow defraud the insurance company, that these parts didn't exist, but yet we do know that they were on the car. And the third prong is that she in some way sought to make this plan succeed. How did she do that? The only thing she did was when these cars were either damaged or stolen, she signed off on her lien to the title and let Angela have the money back to purchase the next car. She just wanted to get paid for car number one, which she used her funds to purchase. The government now says, we didn't suppress. But why does that give them a right to misrepresent? Misrepresent to the jury crucial facts that they're saying that's what activity ties her to the conspiracy. And it's a complete misrepresentation by all of the evidence that we know, the exhibits we know.
Did she sign key documents in the scheme like the sales agreements, the title applications? Was she the nominal purchaser of the vehicle?
Yes. What she did was, is the...
Then where are they, what are they misrepresenting? Such a serious thing.
What my client did merely was assign the title over to Angela. That's what she did. Angela then, or Joe, takes it to the DMV, and the DMV issues the title in Angela's name with a lien of Essie on it. When the checks come from the insurance company, in order for the checks to be paid, she has to sign off on the lien. That's all she did in this case, Your Honor. How does that make her knowledgeable about a scheme, about a conspiracy, or trying to make the plan succeed? She's helping out her daughter-in-law and her son purchase another vehicle. That's what she's doing in this case.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Agent. Mr. Barber, I'm going to check on your time. You had no time, but you had a fair amount of questions, so you may have an extra minute.
Just a couple quick points. The government suggests that we're making a reliance argument, and to the extent that there was any reliance, it's actually on the truthful aspect of the performance plus receipt, the actual price of the rims and tires. What we're not suggesting, and this is why that question about would they have relied or would it have a tendency to influence their decision, what we don't know is how the insurance company would have handled it or dealt with the fact about the provenance of the receipt. And that's an important distinction because points out that we're not making a reliance argument. One of the things about asking for the receipts, and I think it's important, I didn't pick it up the first time I read it through the trial transcript, but when I went back and looked at the trial transcript, I think you'll see when they talk about asking for receipts for verification or asking for receipts during the process, it's always in the context of the missing stereo equipment, not the rims and tires that the AAA representative looks at and sees and is able to verify the damage to them. And those are the two main points, Your Honors, and we'd ask that you reverse on count five at a minimum and remand for resentencing.
Thank you, Mr. Barber. Our thanks to all counsel. Mr. Abrams, you were retained in this case.
Yes.
All right. Mr. Barber, and is that Mr. Jones with you?
Yes.
I want to extend an extra thanks on behalf of the court for your accepting the appointment and so ably representing you. The case is taken under advisement.